were on their feet at once. It fell to Roger Riswell and Barbary Dustin to calm them with quiet words. Roose Bolton said nothing at all, but Theon Greyjoy saw a look in his pale eyes that he had never seen before, an uneasiness, even a hint of fear. That night the new stable collapsed beneath the weight of the snow that had buried it. 26 horses and 2 grooms died, crushed beneath the falling roof or smothered under the snows. It took the best part of the morning to dig out the bodies. Lord Bolton appeared briefly in the outer ward to inspect the scene, then ordered the remaining horses brought inside, along with the mount still tethered in the outer ward. And no sooner had the men finished digging out the dead men and butchering the horses than another corpse was found. This one could not be waved away as some drunken tumble or the kick of a horse. The dead man was one of Ramsay's favourites, the squat, scrofulous, ill-favoured man-at-arms called Yellow Dick. Whether his dick had actually been yellow was hard to determine, as someone had sliced it off and stuffed it into his mouth so forcefully they had broken 3 of his teeth. When the cooks found him outside the kitchens, buried up to his neck in a snowdrift, both Dick and man were blue from gold. "Burn the body," Roose Bolton ordered, "and see that you do not speak of this. I'll not have this tale spread." The tale spread nonetheless. By midday most of Winterfell had heard, many from the lips of Ramsay Bolton, whose boy Yellow Dick had been.
"When we find the man who did this," Lord Ramsay promised, "I will flay the skin off him, cook it crisp as crackling, and make him eat it, every bite."
Word went out that the killer's name would be worth a golden dragon. The reek within the great hall was palpable by eventide. With hundreds of horses, dogs, and men squeezed underneath one roof, the floor slimy with mud and melting snow, horse shit, dog turds, and even human feces, the air redolent with the smells of wet dog, wet wool, and sodden horse blankets. There was no comfort to be found amongst the crowded benches, but there was food. The cooks served up great slabs of fresh horse meat, charred outside and bloody red within, with roast onions and neeps, and for once the common soldiers ate as well as the lords and knights. The horse meat was too tough for the ruins of Theon's teeth. His attempts to chew gave him excruciating pain, so he mashed the neeps and onions together with the flat of his dagger and made a meal of that, then cut the horse up very small, sucked on each piece, and spat it out. That way, at least, he had the taste and some nourishment from the grease and blood. The bone was beyond him, though, so he tossed it to the dogs and watched Grey Jane make off with it while Sarah and Willow snapped at her heels. Lord Bolton commanded Abel to play for them as they ate. The bard sang Iron Lances, then The Winter Maid. When Barbary Dustin asked for something more cheerful, he gave them The Queen Took Off Her Sandal, The King Took Off His Crown, and The Bear and the Maiden Fair. The Freys joined the singing, and even a few Northmen slammed their fists on the table to the chorus bellowing, "A bear! A bear!" But the noise frightened the horses, so the singers soon let off, and the music died away. The bastards' boys gathered beneath a wall sconce, where a torch was flaming smokily. Luton and Skinner were throwing dice. Grunt had a woman in his lap, a breast in his hand. Damon Dance for Me sat greasing up his whip. "Reek!" he called. He tapped the whip against his scarf, as a man might do to summon his dog. "You're starting to stink again, Reek." Theon had no reply for that beyond a soft, "Yes." "Lord Ramsay means to cut your lips off when all this is done," said Damon, stroking his whip with a greasy rag. "My lips have been between his lady's legs. That insolence cannot go unpunished. As you say." Luton guffawed. "I think he wants it." "Go away, Reek," Skinner said. "The smell of you turns my stomach." The others laughed. he fled quickly before they changed their minds. His tormentors would not follow him outside. Not so long as there was food and drink within, willing women and warm fires. As he left the hall, Abel was singing "The Maids That Bloom in Spring." Outside, the snow was coming down so heavily that Theon could not see more than 3 feet ahead of him. He found himself alone in a white wilderness, walls of snow looming up to either side of him, chest high. When he raised his head, the snowflakes brushed his cheeks like cold, soft kisses. He could hear the sound of music from the hall behind him, a soft song now, and sad. For a moment, he felt almost at peace. Further on, he came upon a man striding in the opposite direction, a hooded cloak flapping behind him. When they found themselves face to face, their eyes met briefly. The man put a hand on his dagger. "Theon, turn, cloak. Theon, Kinslayer." "I'm not. I was Ironborn." "False is all you were. How is it you still breathe?"
"The guards are not done with me," Theon answered, wondering if this could be the killer,
the Nightwalker who had stuffed Yellow Dick's cock into his mouth and pushed Roger Rysewell's groom off the battlements. Oddly, he was not afraid. He pulled the glove from his left hand. "Lord Ramsay is not done with me." The man looked and laughed.
"I leave you to him, then."
Theon trudged through the storm until his arms and legs were caked with snow and his hands and feet had gone numb from cold, then climbed to the battlements of the inner wall again. Up here, 100 feet high, a little wind was blowing, stirring the snow. All the crenels had filled up. Theon had to punch through a wall of snow to make a hole, only to find that he could not see beyond the moat. Of the outer wall, nothing remained but a vague shadow and a few dim lights floating in the dark.
"The world is gone.
King's Landing, River Run, Pike, and the Iron Islands, all the Seven Kingdoms, every place that he had ever known, every place that he had ever read about or dreamed of, all gone. Only Winterfell remained. He was trapped here with the ghosts, the old ghosts from the crypts, and the younger ones that he had made himself, Mickon and Farlan, Jaina Rednose, Edgar, Gelmar the Grim, the miller's wife from Acorn Water, and her two young sons, and all the rest.
"My work, my ghosts, they're all here, and they are angry."
He thought of the crypts and those missing swords. Theon returned to his own chambers. He was stripping off his wet clothes when Steelshanks Walton found him.
"Come with me, Turncloak. His lordship wants words with you."
He had no clean, dry clothes, so he wriggled back into the same damp rags and followed. Steelshanks led him back to the great keep and the solar that had once been Eddard Stark's. Lord Bolton was not alone. Lady Dustin sat with him, pale-faced and severe. An iron horsehead brooch clasped Roger Rysewell's cloak. Aenys Frey stood near the fire, pinched cheeks flushed with cold.
"I'm told you have been wandering the castle," Lord Bolton began. "Men have reported seeing you in the stables, in the kitchens, in the barracks, on the battlements. You have been observed near the ruins of Collapse Keeps, outside Lady Caitlin's old sept, coming and going from the Guards Wood. Do you deny it?"
"No, my lord."
Theon made sure to muddy up the word. He knew that pleased Lord Bolton.
"I cannot sleep, my lord. I walk."
He kept his head down, fixed upon the old stale rushes scattered on the floor. It was not wise to look his lordship in the face.
"I was a boy here before the war, a ward of Eddard Stark."
"You were a hostage," Bolton said.
"Yes, my lord, a hostage. It was my home, though. Not a true home, but the best I ever knew. Someone has been killing my men." "Yes, my lord."
"Not you, I trust. Bolton's voice grew even softer. "You would not repay all my kindnesses with such treachery?"
"No, my lord, not me. I wouldn't. I only walk, is all."
Lady Dustin spoke up.
"Take off your gloves."
Theon glanced up sharply.
"Oh, please, no, I...
"Do as she says," Sir Aenys said. "Show us your hands." Theon peeled his gloves off and held his hands up for them to see. "It is not as if I stood before them naked. It is not so bad as that." His left hand had three fingers, his right four. Ramsay had taken only the pinky off the one, the ring finger and four fingers from the other.
"The bastard did this to you," Lady Dustin said. "If it pleased my lady, I asked it of him."
Ramsay always made him ask.
"Ramsay always makes me beg."
"Why would you do that?"
I did not need so many fingers."
"Four is enough." Sir Aenys Frey fingered the wispy brown beard that sprouted from his weak chin like a rat's tail. "Four in his right hand. He could still hold a sword, a dagger." Lady Dustin laughed.
"Are all Freys such fools? Look at him. Hold a dagger? He hardly has the strength to hold a spoon. Do you truly think he could have overcome the bastard's disgusting creature and shoved his manhood down his throat?"
"These dead were all strong men," said Roger Riswell, "and none of them were stabbed. The turncloak's not our killer."
Roose Bolton's pale eyes were fixed on Theon, as sharp as Skinner's flaying knife.
"I am inclined to agree. Strength aside, he does not have it in him to betray my son."
Roger Riswell grunted. "If not him, who? Stannis has some man inside the castle. That's plain."
"Reek is no man. Not Reek. Not me."
He wondered if Lady Dustin had told them about the crypts, the missing swords.
"We must look at Manderley," muttered Sir Aenys Frey. "Lord Wyman loves us not."
Riswell was not convinced. "He loves his steaks and chops and meat pies, though. Prowling the castle by dark would require him to leave the table. The only time he does that is when he seeks the privy for one of his hour-long squats." "I do not claim Lord Wyman does the deeds himself. He brought 300 men with him, 100 knights. Any of them might have—"
"Night work is not knight's work," Lady Dustin said. "And Lord Wyman is not the only man who lost kin at your red wedding, Frey. Do you imagine a horsebane loves you any better? If you did not hold the Great John, he would pull out your entrails and make you eat them, as Lady Hornwood ate her fingers. Flynn Serwin's tall hearts, Sleets, they all had men with a young wolf."
"House Riswell, too," said Roger Riswell.
"Even Dustin's out of Barrowton."
Lady Dustin parted her lips in a thin, feral smile.
"The North remembers, Frey."
Aenys Frey's mouth quivered with outrage.
"Stark dishonored us. That is what your Northmen had best remember."
Roose Bolton rubbed at his chapped lips.
"This squabbling will not serve." He flicked his fingers at Theon. "You are free to go. Take care where you wander, else it might be you we find upon the morrow, smiling a red smile."
"As you say, my lord."
Theon drew his gloves on over his maimed hands and took his leave, limping on his maimed foot. The Hour of the Wolf found him still awake, wrapped in layers of heavy wool and greasy fur, walking yet another circuit of the inner walls, hoping to exhaust himself enough to sleep. His legs were caked with snow to the knee, his head and shoulders shrouded in white. On this stretch of the wall, the wind was in his face, and melting snow ran down his cheeks like icy tears. Then he heard the horn. A long, low moan. It seemed to hang above the battlements, lingering in the black air, soaking deep into the bones of every man who heard it.
All along the castle walls, sentries turned toward the sound, their hands tightening around the shafts of their spears. In the ruined halls and keeps of Winterfell, lords hushed other lords, horses nickered, and sleepers stirred in their dark corners. No sooner had the sound of the war horn died away than a drum began to beat. Boom-doom, boom-doom, boom-doom. And a name passed from the lips of each man to the next, written in small white puffs of breath. Stannis, they whispered. Stannis is here. Stannis is come. Stannis, Stannis, Stannis. Theon shivered. Baratheon or Bolton, it made no matter to him. Stannis had made common cause with Jon Snow at the wall, and Jon would take his head off in a heartbeat. Plucked from the clutches of one bastard to die at the hands of another. What a jape! Theon would have laughed aloud if he'd remembered how. The drumming seemed to be coming from the Wolf's Wood beyond the Hunter's Gate. They are just outside the walls. Theon made his way along the wall walk, one more man amongst a score doing the same. But even when they reached the towers that flanked the gate itself, there was nothing to be seen beyond the veil of white. "Do they mean to try and blow our walls down?" japed a flint when the war horn sounded once again. "Mayhaps he thinks he's found the horn of Jeremon." "Is Stannis fool enough to storm the castle?" a sentry asked. "Is not Robert," declared a baritone man. "He'll sit, see if he don't. Try and starve us out."
"He'll freeze his balls off first,"
another sentry said. "We should take the fight to him," declared a Frey. "Do that," Theon thought. "Ride out into the snow and die. Leave Winterfell to me and the ghosts." Roose Bolton would welcome such a fight, he sensed. "He needs an end to this." The castle was too crowded to withstand a long siege, and too many of the lords here were of uncertain loyalty. Fat Wyman Manderly, Horsban Umber, the men of House Hornwood and House Tallheart, the Locks and Flints and Risewells, all of them were Northmen, sworn to House Stark for generations beyond count. It was the girl who held them here, Lord Eddard's blood, but the girl was just a mummer's ploy, a lamb in a direwolf skin. So why not send the Northmen forth to battle Stannis before the farce unravelled? Slaughter in the snow, and every man who falls is one less foe for the Dreadfort. Theon wondered if he might be allowed to fight. Then at least he might die a man's death, sword in hand. That was a gift Ramsay would never give him, but Lord Roose might.
"If I beg him, I did all he asked of me. I played my part. I gave the girl away."
Death was the sweetest deliverance he could hope for. In the Guardswood, the snow was still dissolving as it touched the earth. Steam rose off the hot pools, fragrant with the smell of moss and mud and decay. A warm fog hung in the air, turning the trees into sentinels, tall soldiers shrouded in cloaks of gloom. During daylight hours, the steamy wood was often full of Northmen, come to pray to the old gods. But at this hour, Theon Greyjoy found he had it all to himself. And in the heart of the wood, the Weirwood waited, with its knowing red eyes. Theon stopped by the edge of the pool and bowed his head before its carved red face. Even here, he could hear the drumming. Boom-doom, 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 boom-doom. Like distant thunder, the sound seemed to come from everywhere at once. The night was windless, the snow drifting straight down out of a coal black sky, yet the leaves of the heart tree were rustling his name.
"Theon,"
they seemed to whisper.
"Theon."
"The old gods," he thought. "They know me. They know my name. I was Theon of House Greyjoy. I was a ward of Eddard Stark, a friend and brother to his children. Please,"
He fell to his knees. "A sword, that's all I ask. Let me die as Theon, not as Reek."
Tears trickled down his cheeks, impossibly warm.
"I was Ironborn, a son of Pike, of the islands."
A leaf drifted down from above, brushed his brow, and landed in the pool. It floated on the water, red, five-fingered, like a bloody hand.
"Bran,"
the tree murmured.
"They know. The gods know. They saw what I did."
And for one strange moment, it seemed as if it were Bran's face carved into the pale trunk of the weirwood, staring down at him with eyes red and wise and sad.
"Bran's ghost," he thought.
But that was madness. Why should Bran want to haunt him? He had been fond of the boy, had never done him any harm.
It was not Bran we killed, it was not Rickon. They were only miller's sons, from the mill, by the Acorn Water. I had to have two heads, else they would have mocked me, laughed at me.
A voice said,
"Who are you talking to?"
Theon spun, terrified that Ramsay had found him. But it was just the washerwomen, Holly, Rowan, and one whose name he did not know.
"The ghosts," he blurted. "They whisper to me. They know my name." "Theon Turncloak."
Rowan grabbed his ear, twisting.
"You had to have two heads, did you?"
"Elsewise, men would have laughed at him," said Holly.
"They do not understand." Theon wrenched free. "What do you want?" he asked.
"You,"
said the third washerwoman, an older woman, deep-voiced, with grey streaks in her hair.
"I told you, I want to touch you, Turncloak."
Holly smiled. In her hand a blade appeared.
"I could scream," Theon thought. "Someone will hear. The castle is full of armed men."
He would be dead before help reached him, to be sure, his blood soaking into the ground to feed the heart tree.
"And what would be so wrong with that?" "Touch me," he said. "Kill me."
There was more despair than defiance in his voice.
"Go on, do me, the way you did the others, Yellow Dick and the rest. It was you."
Holly laughed.
"How could it be us? We're women, teats and cunnies, here to be fucked, not feared." "Did the bastard hurt you?"
Rowan asked.
"Chopped off your fingers, did he? Skinned your whittle toes? Knocked your teeth out, poor lad?"
She patted his cheek.
"There will be no more of that, I promise. You prayed, and the gods sent us. You want to die as Theon? We'll give you that. A nice, quick death. 'Twill hardly hurt at all."
She smiled.
"But not till you've sung for Abel. He's waiting for you."
Bran. The sound was the faintest of clinks, a scraping of steel over stone. He lifted his head from his paws, listening, sniffing at the night. The evening's rain had woken 100 sleeping smells and made them ripe and strong again. Grass and thorns, blackberries broken on the ground, mud, worms, rotting leaves, a rat creeping through the bush. He caught the shaggy black scent of his brother's coat and the sharp, coppery tang of blood from the squirrel he'd killed. Other squirrels moved through the branches above, smelling of wet fur and fear, their little claws scratching at the bark. The noise had sounded something like that. And he heard it again, clink and scrape. It brought him to his feet. His ears pricked and his tail rose. He howled, a long, deep, shivery cry, a howl to wake the sleepers. But the piles of man-rock were dark and dead. A still, wet night. A night to drive men into their holes. The rain had stopped, but the men still hid from the damp, huddled by the fires in their caves of pile stone. His brother came sliding through the trees, moving almost as quiet as another brother he remembered dimly from long ago, the white one with the eyes of blood. This brother's eyes were pools of shadow, but the fur on the back of his neck was bristling. He had heard the sounds as well, and known they meant danger. This time the clink and scrape were followed by a slithering and the soft, swift patter of skin feet on stone. The wind brought the faintest whiff of a man smell he did not know, stranger, danger, death. He ran toward the sound, his brother racing beside him. The stone dens rose before them, walls slick and wet. He bared his teeth, but the man rock took no notice. A gate loomed up, a black iron snake coiled tight about bar and post. When he crashed against it, the gate shuddered, and the snake clanked and slithered and held. Through the bars he could look down the long stone burrow that ran between the walls to the stony field beyond. But there was no way through. He could force his muzzle between the bars, but no more. Many a time his brother had tried to crack the black bones of the gate between his teeth, but they would not break. They had tried to dig under, but there were great flat stones beneath, half covered by earth and blown leaves. Snarling, he paced back and forth in front of the gate, then threw himself at it once more. It moved a little and slammed him back.
"Locked," something whispered. "Chained."
The voice he did not hear, the scent without a smell. The other ways were closed as well. Where doors opened in the walls of Man Rock, the wood was thick and strong. There was no way out.
"There is,"
the whisper came, and it seemed as if he could see the shadow of a great tree covered in needles, slanting up out of the black earth to 10 times the height of a man. Yet when he looked about, it was not there.
"The other side of the guard's wood. The sentinel. Hurry, hurry."
Through the gloom of night came a muffled shout, cut short. Swiftly, swiftly, he whirled and bounded back into the trees. Wet leaves rustled beneath his paws, branches whipping at him as he rushed past. He could hear his brother following close. They plunged under the heart tree and around the cold pool, through the blackberry bushes, under a tangle of oaks and ash and hawthorn scrub, to the far side of the wood, and there it was. The shadow he'd glimpsed without seeing, the slanting tree pointing at the rooftops. "Sentinel," came the thought. He remembered how it was to climb it then. The needles everywhere, scratching at his bare face and falling down the back of his neck. The sticky sap on his hands. The sharp, piney smell of it. It was an easy tree for a boy to climb, leaning as it did, crooked, the branches so close together they almost made a ladder slanting right up to the roof. Growling, he sniffed around the base of the tree, lifted a leg, and marked it with a stream of urine. A low branch brushed his face, and he snapped at it, twisting and pulling until the wood cracked and tore. His mouth was full of needles and the bitter taste of the sap. He shook his head and snarled. His brother sat back on his haunches and lifted his voice in an ululating howl, his song black with mourning. The way was no way. They were not squirrels, nor the cubs of men. They could not wriggle up the trunks of trees, clinging with soft pink paws and clumsy feet. They were runners, hunters, prowlers. Off across the night, beyond the stone that hemmed them close, the dogs woke and began to bark. One and then another, and then all of them, a great clamour. They smelled it too, the scent of foes and fear. A desperate fury filled him, hot as hunger. He sprang away from the wall, loped off beneath the trees, the shadows of branch and leaf dappling his grey fur. And then he turned and raced back in a rush. His feet flew, kicking up wet leaves and pine needles, and for a time he was a hunter, and an antlered stag was fleeing before him, and he could see it, smell it, and he ran full out in pursuit. The smell of fear made his heart thunder, and slaver ran from his jaws. And he reached the falling tree in stride and threw himself up the trunk, claws scrabbling at the bark for purchase. Upward he bounded, up, two bounds, three, hardly slowing, until he was among the lower limbs. Branches tangled at his feet and whipped at his eyes, grey-green needles scattered as he shouldered through them, snapping. He had to slow. Something snagged at his foot, and he wrenched it free, snarling. The trunk narrowed under him, the slope steeper, almost straight up and wet. The bark tore like skin when he tried to claw at it. He was a third of the way up, halfway, more. The roof was almost within reach, and then he put down a foot and felt it slip off the curve of wet wood, and suddenly he was sliding, stumbling. He yowled in fear and fury, falling, falling, and twisted around while the ground rushed up to break him. And then Bran was back abed in his lonely tower room, tangled in his blankets, the breath coming hard. "Summer!" he cried aloud. "Summer!" His shoulder seemed to ache, as if he'd fallen on it, but he knew it was only the ghost of what the wolf was feeling. Jojen told it true. "I am a beastling." Outside he could hear the faint barking of dogs. The sea has come. It's flowing over the walls, just as Jojen saw. Bran grabbed the bar overhead and pulled himself up, shouting for help. No one came, and after a moment he remembered that no one would. They had taken the guard off his door. Sir Roderick had needed every man of fighting age he could lay his hands on, so Winterfell had been left with only a token garrison. The rest had left 8 days past. 600 men from Winterfell and the nearest Holdfast. Clay Serwyn was bringing 300 more to join them on the march, and Maester Lewin had sent ravens before them, summoning levies from White Harbour and the Barrowlands and even the deep places inside the Wolf's Wood. Torren Square was under attack by some monstrous war chief named Dagmer Clefjaw. Old Nan said he couldn't be killed, that once a foe had cut his head in two with an axe, but Dagmer was so fierce he'd just pushed the two halves back together and held them until they healed up. Could Dagmer have won? Torren Square was many days from Winterfell, yet still. Bran pulled himself from the bed, moving bar to bar until he reached the windows. His fingers fumbled a little as he swung back the shutters. The yard was empty, and all the windows he could see were black. Winterfell slept. "Hodor!" he shouted down as loud as he could. Hodor would be asleep above the stables, but maybe, if he yelled loud enough, he'd hear, or somebody would. "Hodor, come fast! Usher, Mira, Jojen, anyone!" Bran cupped his hands together around his mouth. "Hodor!" But when the door crashed open behind him, the man who stepped through was no one Bran knew. He wore a leather jerkin, sewn with overlapping iron discs, and carried a dirk in one hand and an axe strapped to his back. "What do you want?" Bran demanded, afraid. "This is my room. You get out of here." Theon Greyjoy followed him into the bedchamber. "We're not here to harm you, Bran." "Theon." Bran felt dizzy with relief. "Did Rob send you? Is he here too?" "Rob's far away. He can't help you now." "Help me?" He was confused. "Don't scare me, Theon." "I'm Prince Theon now. We're both princes, Bran. Who would have dreamed it, eh? But I've taken your castle, my prince." "Winterfell?" Bran shook his head. "No, you couldn't." "Leave us, Warleg." The man with the dirk withdrew. Theon seated himself on the bed. "I sent 4 men over the walls with grappling claws and ropes, and they opened a postern gate for the rest of us. My men are dealing with yours even now. I promise you, Winterfell is mine." Bran did not understand. "But your father's ward. And now you and your brothers are my wards,
As soon as the fighting's done, my men will be bringing the rest of your people together in the Great Hall. You and I are going to speak to them. You'll tell them how you've yielded Winterfell to me and command them to serve and obey their new lord as they did the old." "I won't," said Bran. "We'll fight you and throw you out. I never yielded. You can't make me say I did." "This is no game, Bran, so don't play the boy with me. I won't stand for it. The castle is mine, but these people are still yours. If the prince would keep them safe, he'd best do as he's told." He rose and went to the door. "Someone will come to dress you and carry you to the great hall. Think carefully on what you want to say." The waiting made Bran feel even more helpless than before. He sat in the window seat, staring out at dark towers and walls black as shadow. Once he thought he heard shouting beyond the guards' hall, and something that might have been the clash of swords, but he did not have Summer's ears to hear, nor his nose to smell. "Awake, I'm still broken, but when I sleep, when I'm Summer, I can run and fight and hear and smell." He had expected that Hodor would come for him, or maybe one of the serving girls, but when the door next opened, it was Maester Lewin carrying a candle.
"Bran," he said, you know what has happened? You have been told?"
The skin was broken above his left eye, and blood ran down that side of his face.
"Theon came. He said Winterfell was his now."
The Maester set down the candle and wiped the blood off his cheek.
"They swam the moat and climbed the walls with hook and rope. Came over wet and dripping, steel in hand."
He sat in the chair by the door as fresh blood flowed.
"Alebelly was on the gate. They surprised him in the turret and killed him. Hayhead's wounded as well. I had time to send off two ravens before they burst in. The bird to White Harbour got away, but they brought down the other with an arrow."
The Maester stared at the rushes.
"Sir Roderick took too many of our men, but I am to blame as much as he is. I never saw this danger. I never—"
"Jojen saw it," Bran thought.
"You'd better help me dress." "Yes, that's so." In the heavy iron-bound chest at the foot of Bran's bed, the Maester found small clothes, breeches, and tunic. "You are the Stark in Winterfell, and Robb's heir. You must look princely." Together they garbed him as befit a lord.
"Theon wants me to yield the castle," Bran said, as the Maester was fastening the cloak with his favourite wolf's head clasp of silver and jet.
"There is no shame in that. A lord must protect his small folk. Cruel places breed cruel peoples, Bran. Remember that as you deal with these iron men. Your lord father did what he could to gentle Theon, but I fear it was too little and too late."
The iron man who came for them was a squat, thick-bodied man with a coal-black beard that covered half his chest. He bore the boy easily enough, though he looked none too happy with the task. Rickon's bedchamber was a half-turn down the steps. The four-year-old was cranky at being woken.
"I want mother," he said. "I want her, and Shaggy Dog too."
"Your mother is far away, my prince."
Maester Lewin pulled a bedrobe over the child's head.
"But I am here, and Bran."
He took Rickon by the hand and led him out. Below they came on Mira and Jojen, being herded from their room by a bald man whose spear was 3 feet taller than he was. When Jojen looked at Bran, his eyes were green pools full of sorrow. Other iron men had rousted the phrase.
"Your brother's lost his kingdom," little Walder told Bran. "You're no prince now, just a hostage."
"So are you," Jojen said, "and me, and all of us."
"No one was talking to you, frog eater."
One of the iron men went before them carrying a torch, but the rain had started again and soon drowned it out. As they hurried across the yard, they could hear the dire wolves howling in the godswood. I hope Summer wasn't hurt, falling from the tree.
Theon Greyjoy was seated in the high seat of the Starks. He had taken off his cloak. Over a shirt of fine mail, he wore a black surcoat emblazoned with the golden kraken of his house. His hands rested on the wolf's heads, carved at the ends of the wide stone arms.
"Theon's sitting in Rob's chair,"
Rickon said. "Hush, Rickon." Bran could feel the menace around them, but his brother was too young. A few torches had been lit, and a fire kindled in the great hearth, but most of the hall remained in darkness. There was no place to sit, with the benches stacked against the walls, so the castle folk stood in small groups, not daring to speak. He saw old Nan, her toothless mouth opening and closing. Hayhead was carried in between two of the other guards, a blood-stained bandage wrapped about his bare chest. Poxy Tim wept inconsolably, and Beth Cassell cried with fear.
"What have we here?"
Theon asked of the reeds and frays.
"These are Lady Catelyn's wards, both named Walder Frey," Maester Lewin explained. "And this is Jojen Reed and his sister Mira, son and daughter to Howland Reed of Greywater Watch, who came to renew their oaths of fealty to Winterfell."
"Some might call that ill-timed," said Theon, "though not for me."
"Here you are, and here you'll stay," he vacated the high seat. "Bring the prince here, Lauren."
The black-bearded man dumped Bran onto the stone as if he were a sack of oats. People were still being driven into the great hall, prodded along with shouts and the butts of the spears. Gage and Usher arrived from the kitchens, spotted with flour from making the morning bread. Mickon they dragged in, cursing. Farlan entered, limping, struggling to support Parla. Her dress had been ripped in two. She held it up with a clenched fist and walked as if every step were agony. Septon Shale rushed to lend a hand, but one of the Iron Men knocked him to the floor. The last man marched through the doors was the prisoner, Reek, whose stench preceded him, ripe and pungent. Bran felt his stomach twist at the smell of him. "We've found this one locked in a tower cell," announced his escort, a beardless youth with ginger-coloured hair and sodden clothing, doubtless one of those who'd swum the moat.
"He says they call him Reek."
"Can't think why," Theon said, smiling. "Do you always smell so bad, or did you just finish fucking a pig?"
"Haven't fucked no one since they took me, my lord. Heek's me true name. I was in service to the bastard of the Dreadfort till the Starks give him an arrow in his back for a wedding gift."
Theon found that amusing. "Who did he marry?"
"The widow of Ornwood, my lord."
"That crone? Was he blind? She has tits like empty wineskins, dry and withered."
"It wasn't her tits he wed her for, my lord."
The Iron Man slammed shut the tall doors at the foot of the hall. From the high seat, Bran could see about 20 of them. He probably left some guards on the gates and the armory. Even so, there couldn't be more than 30. Theon raised his hands for quiet.
"You all know me."
"Aye, we know you for a sack of steaming dung," shuddered Mickon,
before the bald man drove the butt of his spear into his gut, then smashed him across the face with the shaft. The smith stumbled to his knees and spat out a tooth.
"Mickon, you be silent."
Bran tried to sound stern and lordly, the way Rob did when he made a command, but his voice betrayed him, and the words came out in a shrill squeak.
"Listen to your little lordling, Mickon," Theon said. "He has more sense than you do."
"A good lord protects his people," he reminded himself.
"I've yielded Winterfell to Theon."
"Louder, Bran, and call me Prince." He raised his voice.
"I have yielded Winterfell to Prince Theon. All of you should do as he commands you."
"Damned if I will,"
bellowed Mickon. Theon ignored the outburst.
"My father has donned the ancient crown of salt and rock and declared himself King of the Iron Islands. He claims the north as well, by right of conquest. You are all his subjects."
"Bugger that,"
Micken wiped the blood out of his mouth.
I serve the Starks, not some treasonous squid of...
The butt of the spear smashed him face first into the stone floor.
Smiths have strong arms and weak heads, observed Theon. But if the rest of you serve me as loyally as you serve Ned Stark, you'll find me as generous a lord as you could want.
On his hands and knees, Micken spat blood.
Please don't, Bran wished at him, but the blacksmith shouted, If you think you can hold the north with this sorry love.
The bald man drove the point of his spear into the back of Micken's neck. Steel slid through flesh and came out his throat in a welter of blood. A woman screamed, and Mira wrapped her arms around Rickon.
It's blood he drowned on, Bran thought numbly. His own blood.
Who else has something to say?
Asked Theon Greyjoy.
Hodor, 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 Hodor,
shouted Hodor, eyes wide.
Someone kindly shut that half-wit up.
Two iron men began to beat Hodor with the butts of their spears. The stable boy dropped to the floor, trying to shield himself with his hands.
I will be as good a lord to you as Eddard Stark ever was.
Theon raised his voice to be heard above the smack of wood on flesh.
Betray me, though, and you'll wish you hadn't. And don't think the men you see here are the whole of my power. Turin Square and Deepwood Mutt will soon be ours as well, and my uncle is sailing up the Salt Spear to seize Moat Caitlin. If Robb Stark can stave off the Lannisters, he may reign as King of the Trident hereafter, but House Greyjoy holds the North now.
Stark's lords will fight you, the man Reek called out. That bloated pig at White Harbour, for one. And them Umbers and Karstarks, too. You'll need men. Free me, and I'm yours.
Theon weighed him a moment.
You're cleverer than you smell, but I could not suffer that stench.
Well, said Reek, I could wash some if I was free.
A man of rare good sense, Theon smiled. Bend the knee.
One of the iron men handed Reek a sword, and he laid it at Theon's feet and swore obedience to House Greyjoy and King Balon. Bran could not look. The green dream was coming true.
Milord Greyjoy,
Usher stepped past Micken's body.
I was brought here captive too. You were there the day I was taken.
I thought you were a friend, Bran thought, hurt.
I need fighters, Theon declared, not kitchen slots.
It was Robb Stark put me in the kitchens. For the best part of a year, I'd been left to scour kettles, scrape grease, and warm the straw for this one.
She threw a look at Gage.
I've had a belly full of it. Put a spear in me hand again.
I've got a spear for you right here,
said the bald man who'd killed Micken. He grabbed his crotch, grinning. Usher drove her bony knee up between his legs.
You keep that soft pink thing.
She wrested the spear from him and used the butt to knock him off his feet.
I'll have me the wood and iron.
The bald man writhed on the floor while the other reavers sent up gales of laughter. Theon laughed with the rest.
You'll do, he said. Keep the spear. Steak can find another. Now bend the knee and swear.
When no one else rushed forward to pledge service, they were dismissed with a warning to do their work and make no trouble. Hodor was given the task of bearing Bran back to his bed. His face was all ugly from the beating, his nose swollen and one eye closed.
Hodor,
he sobbed between cracked lips as he lifted Bran in huge, strong arms and bloody hands and carried him back out into the rain. Daenerys. The heart was steaming in the cool evening air when Khal Drogo set it before her, raw and bloody. His arms were red to the elbow. Behind him, his blood riders knelt on the sand beside the corpse of the wild stallion
stone knives in their hands. The stallion's blood looked black in the flickering orange glare of the torches that ring the high chalk walls of the pit. Danny touched the soft swell of her belly. Sweat beaded her skin and trickled down her brow. She could feel the old women watching her, the ancient crones of the Vase Dothrak, with eyes that shone dark as polished flint in their wrinkled faces. She must not flinch or look afraid. "I am the blood of the dragon," she told herself, as she took the stallion's heart in both hands, lifted it to her mouth, and plunged her teeth into the tough, stringy flesh. Warm blood filled her mouth and ran down over her chin. The taste threatened to gag her, but she made herself chew and swallow. The heart of a stallion would make her son strong and swift and fearless, or so the Dothraki believed, but only if the mother could eat it all. If she choked on the blood or retched up the flesh, the omens were less favourable. The child might be stillborn, or come forth weak, deformed or female. Her handmaidens had helped her ready herself for the ceremony. Despite the tender mother's stomach that had afflicted her these past 2 moons, Danny had dined on bowls of half-clotted blood to accustom herself to the taste. Andiri made her chew strips of dried horseflesh until her jaws were aching. She had starved herself for a day and a night before the ceremony in the hopes that hunger would help her keep down the raw meat. The wild stallion's heart was all muscle, and Danny had to worry it with her teeth and chew each mouthful a long time. No steel was permitted within the sacred confines of Vase Dothrak, beneath the shadow of the Mother of Mountains. She had to rip the heart apart with teeth and nails. Her stomach roiled and heaved. Yet she kept on, her face smeared with the heart's blood that sometimes seemed to explode against her lips. Khal Drogo stood over her as she ate, his face as hard as a bronze shield. His long black braid was shiny with oil. He wore gold rings in his moustache, gold bells in his braid, and a heavy belt of solid gold medallions around his waist, but his chest was bare. She looked at him whenever she felt her strength failing, looked at him and chewed and swallowed, chewed and swallowed, chewed and swallowed. Towards the end, Danny thought she glimpsed a fierce pride in his dark, almond-shaped eyes, but she could not be sure. The car's face did not often betray the thoughts within. And finally, it was done. Her cheeks and fingers were sticky as she forced down the last of it. Only then did she turn her eyes back to the old women, the crones of the Dashkalin. "Kalaka Dathre Mahrana," she proclaimed in her best Dothraki. "A prince rides inside me." She had practiced the phrase for days with her handmaid Jiqui. The oldest of the crones, a bent and shriveled stick of a woman with a single black eye, raised her arms on high. "Kalaka Dathre," she shrieked. "The prince is riding." "He is riding," the other women answered. "Rock, rock, rock, Hajj," they proclaimed. "A boy, a boy, a strong boy." Bells rang, a sudden clangor of bronze birds. A deep-throated warhorn sounded its long, low note. The old women began to chant. Underneath their painted leather vests, their withered dug swayed back and forth, shiny with oil and sweat. The eunuchs who served them threw bundles of dried grasses into a great bronze brazier, and clouds of fragrant smoke rose up toward the moon and the stars. The Dothraki believed the stars were horses made of fire, a great herd that galloped across the sky by night. As the smoke ascended, the chanting died away, and the ancient crone closed her single eye, the better to peer into the future. The silence that fell was complete. Danny could hear the distant call of night birds, the hiss and crackle of the torches,
the gentle lapping of water from the lake. The Dothraki stared at her with eyes of night, waiting. Khal Drogo laid his hand on Danny's arm. She could feel the tension in his fingers. Even a Khal as mighty as Drogo could know fear when the Dush Kaleen peered into smoke of the future. At her back, her handmaids fluttered anxiously. Finally, the crone opened her eye and lifted her arms.
"I have seen his face and heard the thunder of his hooves," she proclaimed in a thin, wavery voice.
"The thunder of his hooves," the others chorused.
"As swift as the wind he rides, and behind him his Khalasar covers the earth, men without number, with arcs shining in their hands like blades of razor glass. Fierce as a storm this prince will be, his enemies will tremble before him, their wives will weep tears of blood and rend their flesh in grief. The bells in his ear will sing his coming, and the milkmen in their stone tents will fear his name."
The old woman trembled and looked at Danny almost as if she were afraid.
"The prince is riding, and he shall be the stallion who mounts the world."
"The stallion who mounts the world," the onlookers cried in echo, until the night rang to the sound of their voices. The one-eyed crone peered at Danny.
"What shall he be called, this stallion who mounts the world?"
She stood to answer. "He shall be called Rago," she said, using the words that Jiqui had taught her. Her hands touched the swell beneath her breasts protectively as a roar went up from the Dothraki. "Rago!" they screamed. "Rago! Rago! Rago!" The name was still ringing in her ears as Khal Drogo led her from the pit. His blood riders fell in behind them. A procession followed them out onto the God's Way, the broad grassy road that ran through the heart of Vaes Dothrak, from the Horse Gate to the Mother of Mountains. The crones of the Dush Kaleen came first, with their eunuchs and slaves. Some supported themselves with tall carved staffs as they struggled along on ancient, shaking legs, whilst others walked as proud as any horse lord. Each of the old women had been a Khaleesi once, when their lord husbands died and a new Khal took his place at the front of his riders with a new Khaleesi mounted beside him. They were sent here to reign over the vast Dothraki nation. Even the mightiest of Khals bowed to the wisdom and authority of the Dush Kaleen. Still, it gave Danny the shivers to think that one day she might be sent to join them, whether she willed it or no. Behind the wise women came the others, Khal Ogo and his son, the Kalaka Fogo, Khal Jomo and his wives, the chief men of Drogo's Khalasar, Danny's handmaids, the Khal's servants and slaves, and more. Bells rang, and drums beat a stately cadence as they marched along the God's Way. Stolen heroes and the gods of dead peoples brooded in the darkness beyond the road. Alongside the procession, slaves ran lightly through the grass with torches in their hands, and the flickering flames made the great monuments seem almost alive.
"What is meaning name Rego?"
Khal Drogo asked as they walked, using the common tongue of the Seven Kingdoms. She had been teaching him a few words when she could. Drogo was quick to learn when he put his mind to it, though his accent was so thick and barbarous that neither Ser Jorah nor Viserys could understand a word he said. "My brother Rhaegar was a fierce warrior, my son and stars," she told him. "He died before I was born. Ser Jorah says he was the last of the dragons." Khal Drogo looked down at her. His face was a copper mask, yet under the long black moustache, drooping beneath the weight of its gold rings, she thought she glimpsed the shadow of a smile.
"Is good name than Eri's wife, moon of my life.